Hello again, friends. It's Monday, May 2nd, 2022. This is In the Know, episode 39. 39 big ones. I don't even know what I'm saying. Next week, Sunday, May the 8th, we're going to be in Genesis 38. And if you haven't read Genesis 38 before, which I hope you have, you just need to know there are some sensitive topics, some more adult materials. They're talked about in a sensitive way, but I understand this could create some conversations that parents might not be ready for. And so because of that, we've decided to make childcare available for all ages, like 1 through 10, and even a little bit older if needed. So you can read through that and see and kind of use your discretion as it relates to how you'll participate next Sunday. Ongoing announcement. Kids Choir is happening at 6 p.m. on Wednesday nights. My kids have really enjoyed it. We've had a couple of kids from Wardville come and a number of kids from our church, and it's been great. So it's still not too late to be part of that. May 15th, we will have a members meeting, and at that meeting, we will vote on Dean Christian as an elder. And so he was put forward yesterday by our elders after having been put forward by a number of people in our church. And so we're asking that over the next couple of weeks, you would pray and fast and consider. I've also made available a document that relates to what eldership is, why elders, and what it means to be qualified as an elder, and then also what eldership looks like in our body. That document is not all the way finished. It's not in its final form, but I am making it available to everyone so that you can consider these things as you pray through it, as you think about it, and hopefully it'll just be edifying to you and show you that our church is striving to be biblical. So we'll vote on that on May the 15th. And then May 22nd is our Sunday evening service. It'll happen at 5 p.m. Let me go into a little bit of sermon recap. And this is going to be different than it often is because the first two points that I'm going to bring out are actually extended sections from commentaries because they were so good that I can't write them as well as they did. And there's no reason even to reinvent the wheel or even try. I'm just going to read those extended quotes to you about these things because they're just really good and they're edifying and they're helpful. Okay, so first, let's talk about God's sovereignty. Both of these quotes come from Bruce Waltke and his commentary called Genesis. He is excellent. He is a brilliant author. And his first paragraph here on God's sovereignty comes from page 492 of his work. He says, God's providence directs the covenant family's life. His providence is asserted in Joseph's double dream, predicting his rule over the family. However, within this obvious theological frame, the story unfolds from a secular point of view, i.e., without angelic or other miraculous interventions. So pause for a second. He's not saying that the Bible is a secular document or even that this section is a secular document. He's saying it's just recording, almost like Esther, from a human perspective and not from like heaven's perspective. He's not saying everything God is up to. He's just showing the events, and looking back, you'll be able to see God's hand in it all. So it's actually very real life for us. Okay, so that's what he means when he says secular point of view. Picking back up. Instead, in retrospect, everything happens at just the right time. Joseph providentially wastes time wandering around Shechem looking for his brothers when he happens to meet a man who had happened to overhear the brothers say where they would go. Without Joseph's delay, the Ishmaelite merchants would not have happened to come along at the right time. On the spur of the moment, it occurs to Judah to sell Joseph, so Joseph happens to end up in Egypt. The favoritism of a father, sibling rivalry culminating in selling the favorite into Egypt as a slave, the crime of the century, and the cover-up all play a part in God's providence to save his elect. The narrative rejects humanism that believes in a God who, quote, has no hands but ours to do the work. As Brueggemann asserts, the narrative works its subtle way between a primitivism, which believes too easily, and a humanism, which is embarrassed about faith. Joseph summarizes the account's sub-theme of God's providence in his famous insight, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Genesis 50, 20. So I want to go into just for a moment this word that you might have seen when we read it yesterday, but I didn't have a chance to talk about it. The meaning was implied to such a degree that I didn't think it was necessary for me to talk about, but because it occurs here, I think it occurs for the first time in Genesis in this passage. I would have to check that to make sure. Either way, because it occurs here, Waltke does a paragraph on it in part of like his theology section. And I think it's really helpful. So here's what he says about Sheol. The Hebrew term for the grave is Sheol, which occurs 66 times in the Old Testament. Only 8 of the occurrences are in prose, and that's like narrative or just normal writing, not poetry. Only 8 of the occurrences are in prose. The prepositions frequently accompanying it indicate that it is a place below the earth, the underworld. On the physical level, it refers to the grave. On the metaphysical, to the realm of death as distinct from the realm of life. The emphasis is on the awfulness of death in comparison to life. Old Testament poets use rich and varied figures of speech in connection with the grave. It has a mouth, Psalm 141:7, which it enlarges, Isaiah 5:14, and is never satisfied, Proverbs 27:20 and 30:16. It is so powerful that none escapes its grip, Psalm 89:48, and no one can redeem another from it. Hosea 13:14, cross-reference Psalm 49:7. It is likened to a prison with bars, Job 17:16. Here, corruption is the father and the worm, the mother and sister, Job 17:13 through 16. It is a land of no return, Job 7:9, an abode where socioeconomic distinctions cease. Rich and poor, Job 3:18 and 19. Righteous and wicked, Job 3:17. Wise and fools, Psalm 49:10. An Israelite and foreigner lie together here. It is a land of silence, Psalm 94:17. Darkness, Psalm 13:3. Weakness and oblivion, Psalm 88:10 through 18. One errs to take such figurative descriptions of the grave as literal depictions of an intermediate state. Other texts teach the immortality of the saint, Job 19, verses 26 and 27, Psalm 49:15, Proverbs 10:2, 12:28, and 14:32. A doctrine brought into full light, that's the immortality of the saint, a doctrine brought into full light through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. 2 Timothy 1:10. I had a Trump moment there. 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy 1:10. I hope it was helpful to read or hear that, however you're taking this in. This word is used poetically to describe the realm of the dead, not necessarily heaven or hell, but it's a catch-all term to juxtapose it with the realm of the living. It's like a Hebrew way of speaking about the fact that the soul has departed and does not participate in this physical worldly existence in the way that the living do. And since we're talking about death, let me mention one other thing that I didn't get to a couple of weeks ago and even forgot to put in the newsletter afterwards, and that's when Rachel dies. Like, since we're talking about death, I want to talk about Rachel's death because the language that it uses in Genesis 35 helps us, even this early in the Bible, to begin refining our theology of what theologians call the intermediate state. That state is the separation of body and soul, and we call it death. Death is the intermediate state between the present form of this world and the final state in which we will live either in heaven or in hell forever. It is the irreversible final state that all humanity will occupy. So when you leave the existence as the living know it, like this existence as the living know it, you enter the intermediate state, but that's just what it is. It's intermediate. So look at how Genesis 35 describes what was happening to Rachel as she was dying. So Genesis 34, 18 and 19. I think I said 35 a minute ago, but it's 34. Actually, we're going to do this live. I'm going to check this to make sure that I get it right. It's 35. I typed it wrong. It's Genesis 35, 18, and 19. And now it will appear correctly in the newsletter when you see it. It says this in Genesis 35, 18, and 19. And as her soul was departing, for she was dying, she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. I want to make two observations. First, her soul was departing from her body. The soul does not go to sleep and then get buried with the body in some sort of comatose state, unconscious state, until Jesus returns and awakens it. The soul departs the body. Death is an intermediate state that happens before the final state, as we said. The intermediate state is unnatural, which is why it's intermediate. The body and soul were meant to be a unified whole, a unity. That the body and soul would be rent into distinct parts, soul and body, in such a violent way is just as unnatural as heaven and earth being separated through human sin. Thanks be to God that Jesus will set this right once again and reunite our new glorified bodies and our perfected holy souls when he comes back. Like, this is what Ephesians 1:10 and Colossians 1:20 mean when Paul talks about the uniting or the reconciling of all things in heaven and earth in him. God is going to bring heaven and earth back together on the last day through Christ. What a hope. So here's the second observation, which is also one that I made about Abraham's burial of Sarah, who died in Genesis 23. Part of what it means to be human is to be an embodied soul or an ensouled body. We are a unified being. Like, there's not really a good way to describe it as discrete parts, because when we're living in the state God made us in, it's hard to know where my soul begins and my body ends. Like, it's so united that we can't divide it into discrete parts like that. I mean, maybe it's helpful to talk about the fact that we are a soul and a body. But I think sometimes we can go too far by saying that in some way, like, the real me lives in the soul and the body is just like this earth suit or this like, almost like the movie Avatar, where it's like the real person is in a different room and their like mind is inhabiting this little body, but that they can take it away and the body just kind of keeps doing its own thing over there. Like, that's not what this is. Like, my body, our bodies, by God's design, they are part of our identity as image bearers of God. That's my body. That's your body. The material world is good. These bodies are good, and they were created by God, and it will be part of the final redemption. Like, it's not just that heaven is forever a place where your soul floats around on a cloud. It's a real physical embodied final state of new heavens and new earth, where heaven and earth are one, and our souls are perfected, and our bodies are glorified and raised, and they're placed back together, never to be separated again. And that will be who we truly are, is this an embodied soul, an ensouled body for all eternity. And so, like, because we're going to be raised immortal, and there will be continuity between our bodies now and our bodies then, I believe that's one of the reasons Moses does not say they buried Rachel's body. Like, it's one thing for him to say they buried Rachel's body, but what he says when he's writing this, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, lest we forget. So when he records the account of Sarah's burial and of Rachel's burial, he doesn't say they buried her body. It says Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, and it says they buried her. She was buried of Rachel. It's not like the real her flew away to God, leaving a mere unimportant shell of dust. No, her body is an integral part of who Rachel is, such that Moses writes, she was buried even as her soul had already departed. So let's not let a bad theology of death, the material world, or the soul affect how we talk about death. And as an example, just recently, like last week at my wife's grandfather's funeral, the officiating pastor made that point. I don't know if he's actually a pastor of a church, but he was the minister there who was doing that. He said, now, Verald is not really here. He's with Jesus, and his body is here. Well, yes and no. Verald is still conscious and alive in some sense, but his body has been and will be part of who he is. This is a transient state of existence for him, and it's not natural. So maybe, it would be best just not to say that, but if you're going to say something like that, you could say, well, he's here and he's not here. And maybe it sounds like this is just splitting theological hairs, but I really believe it matters. Jesus was raised bodily. He exists bodily, and the new heavens and new earth will be an embodied physical existence for the people of God, as it was in the beginning. And I believe that this, if we get this wrong, it affects other things about the way that we view the world and the way that we view stuff. And it can affect even how we preserve and care for the body after death. But I'll just say that's a conversation for another time. For now, I just wanted to talk about that because I think here the Bible is showing us really good theology. Of course, the Bible has good theology, but it's showing us, it's refining our own theology of how we talk about the body and the soul, and how unnatural this intermediate state is. But once again, let me end on a note of hope. Thanks be to God that Christ has overcome the grave. He has overcome Sheol. He will raise us with him, and we will live with him in the new heavens and new earth, never to be separated from him, and never for our bodies and souls to be separated again. Have a great week. I love you, people.